You guys ready?
Yeah.
All right. We're gonna do another session, and of course we're gonna start off the session. Tarek's gonna read something. Then we're gonna do a 2-minute meditation, and then the prayer, and then we'll do another session, and then after that session, our illustrious friend Mr. Mills is going to share some of his experience with contacting this power that he, I think, calls God. So,
this passage is from the book that Brandon read out of, 365 Tao, one of the most profound books I've ever read. I've read it several times over and over, and this one's called Opportunity. A green bird darting in the night. Will you be able to see it? Will you be able to catch it? Cling to spirit like a shadow. Move without a shadow. Times of repression and adversity, like addiction and alcoholism, cannot last forever. How is the transition made to new and better situations? In the midst of great difficulty, a tiny opportunity will open. If only by chance. You must be sharp enough to discern it, quick enough to catch it, and determined enough to do something with it. If you let it pass, you will be filled with regrets. Stick to spirit like a shadow. Wherever it goes, you go. As soon as it throws something your way, catch it by sheer reflex. It is like the bird. If you try to catch it, you will miss. If you're always with it, moving at its speed, as much a part of it as its own shadow, then it's easy to seize it. When you act, however, you in turn must have no shadow. In other words, what you do must leave no messiness, no leftover consequences, nothing that will haunt you later. This is one of the ways in which we avoid creating more bad situations for yourself. Your every movement must be traceless.
Meditation? Prayer.
God, please lay aside everything I think I know about this weekend, the big book, alcoholism, addiction, the 12 steps, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience. Help me see the truth. Amen.
All right. So it was somebody had asked during the break if we would send out signals when we bust a myth. We've already busted three of them. We believe we've busted three of them. If you want to argue with this later, that's okay. What is service? And making coffee being part of service. We feel like we address that being service to the fellowship versus sponsorship being service. We kind of finished up with talking about, you know, are the meetings the program versus, or what, I'm sorry, what is the problem? Is it drugs and alcohol is your problem? We feel like we've addressed that. And then we talked about recovered versus always being recovering. So if you disagree with us and want some further explanation on those, come grab us. Should I hit that?
Let me hit this real quick.
Okay.
This little passage I read about opportunity, in early, you're going to hear old-timers call make reference to the pink cloud, and they're also going to make reference to the window of grace that tends to close. The way I look at it is I tie it back to the voice of the liar that I discussed earlier. The voice of the liar, it gets really soft and dormant when you've been surrendered, when you've been crushed by that self-imposed crisis that you can't postpone or evade. What I believe they are referring to with using words like the pink cloud and the window of grace is the voice of the liar. You know, because the voice of the liar comes back. And I think the objective you have is to complete the steps before the voice of the liar comes back. So that's the opportunity. That's that small window of opportunity that everybody sitting in this room has access to. So maybe up to this point you've been dragging your feet. You haven't connected with a sponsor. You haven't given your commitment to the 12 steps, because I'm a guy who believes that if you're committed to this process, I don't care what step you're on, you will be safe and protected. But what happens to us is our commitment begins to waver. And then the commitment to the steps wavers, and the meetings, and the prayer and meditation, and making amends, and accountability, it all goes out the window. Why? Because the commitment disappears. So the to me, it's the commitment. It keeps you safe and protected. That's the opportunity.
The further you are away from the drink or the drug and not taking any action, the more in danger you are. Because life inevitably will start to get a little bit better and things will start to come back to you. And the unfortunate thing is you start to take credit for that yourself. You start to think that you're the one, that you're the reason that all those things are happening. I don't need God. I don't need these steps. You know, the book says in multiple places, your prospect may be better to deal with when he's depressed, because he wants to get out of wherever he is. But when you start feeling a little bit better, start getting a little bit of money in your pocket, she comes back. You know, I told a guy today when I was talking to him, I said, look, it seems like your wife's kind of turned the heat off a little bit, which scares the hell out of me. Because you seem to be calling me regularly when you were sideways with her, but now that you're kind of getting back in her good graces, you don't see a need to call me anymore. Uh-oh. So, again, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Brandon. Most people don't know what they are, okay? They don't know what they got. So turn to page 108. I can take you to one of these lost chapters that a lot of people want to remove from the book because they don't think they apply. These back chapters, the family afterward, two wives, two employers, and a vision for you, have some of the greatest meat on them that talk about practicing the principles in all our affairs and our ability to look at it. But they also have these little neat little parts where you can kind of look at some stuff and understand what you're dealing with. Okay? So at the bottom of page 108, it says the problem with which you struggle usually falls into one of four categories. So I want you to look at your own experience. And I want you to look at whether or not this is you or if it ever has been you. Okay? And I want you to look at it as it relates to what we'll use alcohol and drugs, because there's too many drugs to go through each one of them. But look at your own experience as it relates to alcohol and drugs. Is this you or has this ever been you? Okay? One. Your husband may be only a heavy drinker. His drinking may be constant, or it may be heavy only on certain occasions. Perhaps he spends too much money for liquor. It may be slowing him up mentally and physically, but he does not see it. Sometimes he is a source of embarrassment to you and his friends. He is positive he can handle his liquor, that it does him no harm, that drinking is necessary in his business. He would probably be insulted if called an alcoholic. This world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether, and some will not. Of those who keep on, a good number will become true alcoholics after a while. So if you substitute crack or heroin or something, in your own experience, because a lot of people, we're busting a myth right here, a lot of people think that alcoholism and drug addiction are the same thing, okay? And that if you're one, you're automatically the other. But as we go through these and you look at your own drinking and using experience, does this type one, who in here, does this apply to them in the way that they drank? Who in here does this apply to them in the way that they used? Okay, not the same hands went up in every case. So clearly, at least that element of alcoholism and drug addiction are a little bit different, okay? Now these go in increasing severity. So we're going to look at number two. Your husband is showing lack of control, for he is unable to put the crack stem down even when he wants to. He gets entirely out of hand when high. He admits this is true, but is positive he will do better. He has begun to try, with or without your cooperation, various means of moderating his crack use or not doing it at all. Maybe he is beginning to lose his friends. His business may suffer somewhat. He is worried at times and is becoming aware that he cannot smoke crack like other people. Sometimes he smokes crack in the morning and all through the day to hold his nervousness in check. When he is remorseful after serious crack smoking bouts where he goes and lives in a box for a little while and tells you that he wants to stop. But when he gets over the spree, he begins to think once more how he can smoke crack moderately next time. We think this person is in danger. These are the real earmarks of a real addict. Perhaps he can still tend to business fairly well. He has by no means ruined everything. As we say among ourselves, he wants to want to stop. Does that apply to anybody drinking? Does that apply to anybody using their drug of no choice? Okay. See how it's a little bit worse, but again, the same hands didn't go up.
There's another myth. You probably should address.
Yeah, there's another myth that people, you hear in meetings all the time, people talking about their drug of choice. Okay? My drug of choice was Maker's Mark and Sprite. Okay? I like to do that. It kind of kept me just right there. But at some point in time, I'd get the beer out, and then I'd go off to the races. What was your drug of choice? You like the LSD and maybe...
Yeah. Can I interject real quick? If you asked me what my drug of choice was before I understood this concept, I would immediately say crack cocaine. But the funny thing is, the thing I call my drug of choice is the one thing I never had any choice over. Right, so I always play a little game with people that I'm talking to in early recovery. Is like, well, if it's your drug of choice, why don't you just make a choice not to do it? So we talk about drugs of no choice. Now, I had a lot of struggle with a lot of drugs that I had loss of control physically, like I couldn't control the amount that I did, but I did not suffer a mental obsession for any of them. So those were, I didn't have mental powerlessness. I could take it or leave it. Now, when I was doing it, I was in it. But when they weren't in my body, I never had my mind take me back to them. So therefore, it was a little bit different sense of powerlessness and choice, right? My real drug of no choice was crack cocaine. It's the only one.
And so people talk about like, well, my drug of choice was this, my drug of choice was that. But you can't have, I mean, you said it before, would your... If you chose to do it, would it make you do all the things that you did? So it was your master. It took you to the places that you had no intention of going to. So where's the choice in that, right? There's no choice there. All right, so.
Does that make sense?
Okay. So now there's kind of a little line that we cross in this book. You got the type 1 and the type 2, okay? And we're going to go into type 3 and type 4. I'll come back and explain what that little line means, okay? So, 3. This husband has gone further than number 2. Though like number 2, he became worse. His friends have slipped away. His home is a near wreck. He cannot hold a position. Maybe the doctor has been called in and the weary rounds of sanitariums and hospitals have begun. He admits he cannot shoot dope like other people, but does not see why. He clings to the notion that he will find a way to do so. He may have come to the point where he desperately wants to stop, but cannot. This case presents questions, which we shall try to answer for you. You can be quite hopeful of a situation like this. Okay, so the weary rounds of doctors have been called in, and the weary rounds of sanitariums and hospitals has begun. So, anybody that explain their drinking career? Okay, how about as it relates to drugs? Anybody? Okay, now I'm going to bust you guys up a little bit here, because the whole room did not raise their hands. Okay, but there is something in here that is interesting. That line, maybe the doctor has been called in and the weary rounds of sanitariums and hospitals has begun. You guys know what sanitariums are? Insane asylums, right? All right, now as I told you before, if you lived in the state of Georgia back before AA was around and before treatment centers were around, and you were an addict or an alcoholic, they sent you down to Milledgeville to the loony bin because you had to be incredibly insane to continue to do the things that you did. Well, once insurance got a hold of it and hospitals and treatment facilities came to the conclusion that this was a lucrative industry, sanitariums were no longer necessary, so they changed the name. You know what they call them now? Rehabs, treatment centers. So, by the fact that most of you have been brought to this place by a program of sorts, I'll ask this question again. Maybe the doctor has been called in and the weary rounds of sanitariums and hospitals has begun. Who in here can relate to type 3? Still not the whole room. So half the room is not paying attention or just doesn't care, because that's where you guys are right now, okay? Some of you maybe went a little bit further and became type 4s. You may have a husband for whom you completely despair. He has been placed in one institution after another. I saw some hands earlier that said that this wasn't their first go-round. He is violent or appears definitely insane when drunk. Sometimes he uses on the way home from the hospital, stops on the way and gets his hookup, right? Anybody ever done that? Perhaps he has had delirium tremens or some other sort of withdrawals. Doctors may shake their heads and advise you to have him committed. Maybe you have already been obliged to put him away. This picture may not be as dark as it looks. Many of our husbands were just as far gone, yet they got well. Now, I never made it all the way to 4. I was a type 3 alcoholic only because there were probably several times where I should have been sent to the hospital, because I was that drunk. When you can puke black tar 8 feet up on a wall, which probably just means that your insides are bleeding and stuff like that, you probably have reached the point where you should be hospitalized. Nobody ever took me, okay? I guess I was too big to carry. They just didn't want to take me. But so I never really made it into treatment facilities and things like that. So I stopped shy of a type 4, okay? Now, some people, that applies to their using but not their drinking. So, Tarek, where do you fall on the spectrum?
In terms of drinking, I'm between a 2 and a 3, because I'm really I want to be as introspective as possible to find myself in this book. And the reality of it, I only fit a few descriptions of the alcoholic that are in this book. But if you were to take the word alcohol out and put cocaine, I fit it all. So I'm a type 4, because this is what happened to me. I was in complete despair. one institution after the other. I was violent. When high, I began psychosis was setting in really quick. What used to take 5 days of staying up was, I would take 3 hits off the crack stem, and I'm hearing voices. That's how it was near the end for me. I bought crack on the way home after being admitted in the ER. I attached DTs to psychosis. Doctors shook their head at me in the ER. They gave me a bunch of NA and AA pamphlets. They brought them all into my room. The picture looked really dark. I was far gone. But I can't say that about alcohol. And I have met very few people in 10 years that can say the same about both. I think it is very rare that you have a full-fledged addict and a real alcoholic. Okay? That's my personal opinion. And the men that I've sponsored over these 10 years.
And I've sponsored guys that have had some part of one and other. I think it's real important to understand what you've got for a couple different reasons. It's real important for you to really get in touch with what your experience is. And the other reason, I'll touch on in a minute, but one of the things that kind of differentiates the type 1 and 2, do you have a question?
Mm-hmm. So we could actually be 2, 3, and 4, or 1.
Correct. I mean, I don't know that I was ever really 1, maybe for the first little while. I was a type 1 for a little while in college. Yeah. I progressed to a 2 probably pretty soon thereafter. And I probably stayed a 2 for 10 years, maybe. I was at the cusp of a 4. I mean, if you give me another month or two of drinking, and I would have, so it's progressive. It always gets worse. It never gets better. And so, but what's confusing about this, guys, is that you go to meetings with a bunch of type 1 and type 2s, okay?
And this is what he's talking about is the most important part of this exercise.
So when you go to a meeting and you hear the guy say that meeting makers make it, here's one of our myths, right? What he's saying is for him, if he goes to meetings, he stays clean and sober. Now, he's probably a type 1 or type 2. Okay, now if you're a type 3 or type 4, meetings ain't going to do shit for you. At some point in time, you try to apply the program of going to meetings to your experience, and you're going to fail. And you're not going to fail just once. You're going to fail over and over and over again. And you're going to get really confused why these people keep saying that meetings are what's going to get you and keep you sober. And you're going to 180 meetings in 30 days, and you're drinking in the car. And you're like, I'm going to the meetings. That works for certain people. A type 1 alcoholic maybe finds the fellowship and he's good. A type 2 addict maybe does a little bit of step work, does one little inventory, reads it to his sponsor, makes amends to the close people in the family, does this living amends thing to everybody else in the world, and stays sober their entire life. And you, as the type 3 or type 4, walks in and looks at this guy going to lunch every day with people, not working a step, not sponsoring anybody, and you're like, there must be something wrong with me because this guy can go to lunch with people and not sponsor anybody and stay sober.
Can I interject? Yeah. Where this becomes extremely important is in those times when you're not in fit spiritual condition and your experience is a sense of separation. And let's say you're a type 4 and don't even know you're a type 4. And all your friends in recovery are type 1s and type 2s. And your sponsor is telling you to do all these crazy things. I need you to pray and meditate every day. I need you to have 3 people in your network you're calling every day. I need you to go to your home group and go to group conscious. And then you got your road dogs, right? Your boys that are in recovery. They're type 1s and type 2s. And you're looking at them going, they don't have to do everything that I do. Well, hell, maybe I can just go do what they do. and then the wheels fall off, right? And so it's really important, because I'm gonna share a story real quick. Mm-hmm. Here's the story. This is how this applies. You take 100 people out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous, and you put them back on the party scene, and you put them back in the bars, and you're going to watch something, right? A third of that group is going to go into the bar, and they're going to drink and do some key bumps just until they feel good, and they're going to turn around and go home. Then you got this other third who's going to walk into that bar, and they're going to belly up to the bar, and they're going to cry in their whiskey and their beer, and they're going to wallow in their bag of boy or bag of girl, and they're going to tell you this is all there is of drugs and alcohol. This is all you can get out of it. And then you got this other third that's going to burn that bar to the ground. They're going to go down to North Avenue and Boulevard, and they're going to hang out in a crack house for a few days, and they're going to burn that to the ground. Then they're going to figure out who to rob and steal to get some more and keep it going. Those are my people. All right, that's my tribe. Now take all those people out of the bar in the party scene and put them back in the rooms of AA and CA. That's how they work the steps. You got one group of people, that third, that treats the meetings like a spiritual filling station, and they suck everything they can out of that meeting, and they're the ones that say, I need a meeting tonight, okay? And so they go to the meeting, and they suck it dry, and they leave.
They bitch about traffic or something.
Yeah. They feel better. They go home. You got another third that's going to go into the meeting and treat it like a group therapy session, right? They're going to want a specific answer for their chick and chit little problem. And that's why they go to the meeting, and they're going to wallow in their big book, and they're going to cry in the meeting, and they're going to tell you this is all there is of these steps in God. And then you got the mad dogs. They're going to go in there, and they're going to be spearheads for God's ever-advancing creation. And they're going to tell the truth, and they're not going to be popular, and their character's going to get assassinated. And they're going to be intelligent agents for God in this 12-step process. You see it all the time. I always ask people, if you were a mad dog for drugs and alcohol, why would you come in here and turn into a little ankle biter? Right? If you're a huge rabid dog out there, here's the question. Are you attacking recovery like you attack drugs and alcohol? That's the question. Simple.
And that's what makes this all so confusing. Now, here's another reason why this is vitally important for you to understand. Derek told you earlier, he speaks crackhead. I speak alcoholic. It was great. It was after one of our CA meetings. Tarek and a bunch of guys were talking about all these different things that they used to smoke stuff out of, right? And they're talking about, you know, the cans and the light bulbs and a potato and some other stuff. And, like, they're talking about it, and I'm fascinated with this conversation, right? And Tarek pauses and goes, guys, look at Brandon. He has no idea what we're talking about. And it was true, because I didn't. I've not done any of that stuff. So if I get a guy, and it's happened, if I get a guy that wants me to take him through the steps, and he starts talking about smoking stuff out of light bulbs, are we going to hook up? Now, if you want to talk about the fact that I was stealing from my little kid's piggy bank, leaving them at the house when they were 2 and 4, and driving to the liquor store to go get some more stuff, you're my people, right? Now, where this is vitally important is not just for you, but for the people that you sponsor. We'll tell you a story about a guy named Nick. Nick, he was an alcoholic. He was also a heroin addict. Okay, he liked to snort it. And Nick asked me to take him through the steps. Well, he was definitely an alcoholic based on what I had seen, so I agreed to do it because, I mean, a drug is a drug is a drug, right? And I know how to work the steps, and I know how to take him through the steps, and he's an alcoholic, so we're good to go. Well, time goes on. He starts kind of struggling. He's doing some withdrawals from some of his medicine. Looks like crap. I tell him about it. And he tells me that I don't know him. He says, you don't know what I'm going through. And I said, you know, I don't know the exact withdrawals that you're going through, but if you call Brandon or Drew or these other guys that are heroin addicts, they can help you through what you're experiencing. Okay? What he heard was, I'm not like you. Okay? And so it corrupted the entire experience to that point. He had something, and it was something in his mind. It was nothing I had done. Something in his mind twisted that to say, this guy's not like me and cannot help me, and I don't care to listen to anything else he says. I don't care to listen to the fact that he's got friends that got my experience. I don't care to listen to any of that. So we have a conversation. I tell Tarek, look, you need to call this guy. Tarek calls him, talks him through it, and Nick's come to the conclusion that he's going to go to the church. We're going to bust another myth here. He's going to go to the church, and if that doesn't work, he's going to come back later on because I know where you guys are. So he's going to keep coming back, right? He believes that he has another shot at this thing. Go to the church. Church doesn't work. Coming back to AA or CA. Okay? Tarek points out to him, you assume you get to come back. He says, I know where you guys are. Click. 2 weeks later, he's dead. You may think you get to keep coming back. It is not up to you. It is not up to you. Okay? That man died because his mind told him that his experience was not my experience and I could not help him. Vitally important for you to understand what you got. Because then you can speak the same language as the person you're trying to take through this experience.
You know, that's why we don't chant at the meetings that I belong to. We don't chant that crap at the end of the meeting. Keep coming back. It works if you work it. A, people think we're a cult for that shit. You can imagine a newcomer walking into a meeting, never been to a meeting, and we're all chanting all these things and inserting.
Works if you work it. So work it. You're worth it.
And so, if you're going to chant something at the end of the meeting, how about the word stay? Okay, let's try the word stay. Because keep coming back presents a false misconception that you just, I'll just come back, no big deal. People relapse behind that delusion that they get to come back and people die. And so we don't, at the groups I belong to, we just don't do it. So.
And if you get if your sponsor is a type 1 or type 2 and he wants you to just kind of go to church with him and maybe have some phone conversations and we're going to do the steps out of the 12 and 12 and all that stuff, I suggest that you ask him some questions about what type of alcoholic or addict he is. Ask him if he believes that his life depends on this. And if you get a him or a haw and a not absolutely, fire him. Go get somebody new.
What step do you guys think? We're sitting here on a Friday night. There are people all over this world that are in AA meetings, CA meetings, and HA meetings at this very moment. What step do you think has brought us all here? What step was all this founded on? So I've heard 3, I heard 12, I heard 1. Any more? Who said that?
Oh, she's got the answer key.
I love you, Kelsey. Kelsey is the winner. And let me explain why this fellowship was founded on step A. Turn to page XVI. So that you guys know about Bill and Bob, right? You know, Bill got sober in December 1934. While Bill was in the hospital, this guy named Ebby came to visit him. And as they and he was working the steps with him, but Bill still had this real resistance to this the God with the human qualities and having a personal relationship with a God. And one night after he's worked the steps, he's sitting in his hospital room and he's in detox and he's, you know, who knows? But he had this experience. He said, "If there is a God, show yourself to me." And the whole room lit up with a light, and there was a breeze that came through the room, and that was his sign that there was something. And the next morning, he ran to Dr. Silkworth, and he's like, "God, I don't know what happened to me last night, Doc, but something's different. I got to go share this with everybody." And Dr. Silkworth let him run around to all the patients in the hospital talking about God is the solution, right? And so he checked out of the hospital a few days later, and he started helping all the winos in Brooklyn. Like, he was digging them out, bringing them home, detoxing them, telling them that God is the answer, and I've got these six steps. You complete deflation, and you have to have moral inventory, and you have to do restitutions to those harmed, and you have to work with others. These are our six steps, and God is the solution. And the winos were like, I ain't having any of that God stuff.
You got some food?
And so 6 months go by. And one night, Bill's finally decided he's going to go try to get a real job because his wife's been working at a department store, and she's making very little money to support them while he's trying to go save all the winos. And Bill's like, I just don't know if this thing's going to work. And Lois looks at him and she says, Bill, but you've stayed sober this whole time. And so he goes off to Akron to do his little business venture, and the business venture fails, and he's walking around the Mayflower Hotel, and he hears all the laughter and all the drinks and the ice from the bar, and he starts pacing back and forth, and then he gets this idea, I got to call another drunk. I got to carry my message of recovery to another drunk. So he goes through the church directory, goes through a few different people, and he ends up at this lady Henrietta's Gatehouse. And Dr. Bob shows up there. I believe it's Mother's Day, 1935. And as Dr. Bob shows up and walks into this house, and he's got his wife with him, he turns to his wife and he says, Martha, this guy gets 15 minutes. You come and get me in 15 minutes, because all this guy's going to do is try to talk to me about how I need to quit drinking and how horrible my drinking is. And I've had people talking to me about that my whole life. Come get me in 15 minutes. So they went into the study, and Bill and Bob sat there and talked for 4 or 5 hours. But what happened was, that was the first time in Bob's life that someone showed up to talk about their drinking. They didn't show up to talk about Bob's drinking. And what Bill did is, he talked to Bob, and right before Bill left on his trip, Dr. Silkworth said, Bill, don't shove God down these people's throat. Why don't you explain to them the baffling features of alcoholism, the loss of control and not being able to control how much you drink, and the physical craving, and then the mental state of mind that continually takes you back to the first drink, and you're doomed to live that life unless you have a vital spiritual experience. But first, explain the hopelessness. And Bill did it with Bob. And it was the first time anyone had explained to Bob what the hell was wrong with him. And then he began to pursue his malady with a willingness he'd never been able to muster before. And Bob stayed sober for... This is the part the book leaves out. He stayed sober for 2 weeks. They talk about it in A Vision for You. Bob stayed sober for 2 weeks, and Bill moved in with Bob. And there was a convention in Atlantic City, and Bob was like, Bill, you can't live with me for the rest of your life. We need to really see if this thing works. And I'm really cool with all these steps, but this step about restitution to those harmed, I'm not cool with that step, man. I could ruin my entire medical practice if I go out into this town and try to repair all this damage I've caused, as if people in that town didn't already know he was a drunk, you know, another delusion. So Bob said, you know, I'll take all of it, but I can't take that step. And so Bob goes to Atlantic City, and he's drunk on the train on the way to Atlantic City. Doesn't even stay the entire week for the convention, and he ends up at his office manager's house. And Bill and Martha have to nurse him back to health, because he gets back on a weekend, and he's got surgery on Tuesday. Okay, now Dr. Bob was a proctologist. And so, my heart always goes out with that for that person that he had surgery with on Tuesday, because he still got the shakes, right? And so they're trying to nurse him back to health. And Bill and Bob at the time were sleeping in the same bedroom, in separate beds. They were sleeping in the same bedroom, and Bob gets up the day of that surgery, and he turns to Bill, and I think he says it either before they leave or when they drop him off at the hospital. He goes, you know what, Bill? I'm going through with it all. Bill paid no mind to it. He thought he was just talking about the surgery. So Bill drives home. Bill and Martha, Bob's wife, are hanging out all day, and there's no sign of Bob. You know, several hours pass by, no sign of Bob. Bill and Martha think Bob's off on another spree. But then Bob comes home late that night. And they're like, Bob, where have you been? He goes, I spent the entire day driving around Akron setting up all my amends. And so all of us sit here tonight because Dr. Bob Smith became willing to make his amends. That's why we're sitting here. If he had not become willing to make those amends, I don't think we'd be here. So,
and just a personal story, why this is so important. I had a drinking buddy of mine that was having some trouble at work. He came to some AA and CA meetings and hung out, and came to the conclusion that he didn't have what we had, and that it was just the stress at work that was causing him to drink the way that he drank. So thank you for the information. I'm good, right? So he goes back. That's you know, towards the end of the year, Super Bowl. Wife gets a restraining order against him because of some incident that, you know, was a misunderstanding, right? Because that always happens. People get restraining orders against them for misunderstandings all the time. And so then he came back to try this thing a little bit too. Stayed a little bit, didn't do any steps. Then something happened in his life. He ended up drunk again. Ends up slitting his throat and his wrists and bleeding out for 16 or 18 hours in a hotel room. Maid comes in the next day, finds him in a pool of blood, goes to the hospital, doesn't die, right? Calls me on a Friday night, tells me what's happened. Saturday, I go over to meet with him. He's really serious. I don't want to go there anymore. I don't want to live this way anymore. We go to lunch. I sit down. I go through pages 59 and 60 and explain what's necessary at each step. We get up to the amends. And he said, I will never make amends to that bitch. So wait a second. You were willing to slit your wrist and your throat and bleed out and die, but you're not going to go make amends to her? Not willing to do it. Just not. So from Friday night to Saturday at lunch, the ego reconstructed in this guy to the point where he was no longer willing to do all this stuff. I wish I could tell you that this was a happy ending. The guy literally parked his car in somebody's living room, spent about 6 or 8 months in jail, has struggled from that day to this with a little bit of sobriety, a little bit of drunkenness, a little bit of sobriety, a little bit of drunkenness. This is a drinking buddy of mine, guys. He sees me. He knows what I'm doing and doesn't want to do this because he is unwilling to do all of the steps, including that one of making an amends. It's that powerful, guys. That powerful.
I always like that story.
All right, I'm on a page, XVI, the one I just asked you guys to turn to. Prior to his journey to Akron, the broker, Bill, had worked with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic can help an alcoholic, but he had succeeded only in keeping sober himself. The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture, which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be Dr. Bob Smith. The physician, Bob Smith, had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, a physical craving coupled with a mental obsession creates powerlessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he'd never been able to muster before. He sobered, never to drink up again, to that moment in his death in 1950. Now, they leave out that relapse. Okay, now if you read a chapter of Vision for You, the relapse is in that chapter. This seemed to prove, and this is the, I read all of that to read this to you.
But we're busting a myth here, and I'll point it out in just a second.
This seemed to prove that one alcoholic can affect another as no non-alcoholic can. One addict can affect another addict as no non-addict can. It also indicates that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, one addict with another, is vital, life-giving, to permanent recovery.
What? Well, hold on a second. Let's read that differently, because this is the way that I hear it in the rooms. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to one day at a time recovery. Does it say that? They say permanent. So where does this one day at a time stuff come from? Now, I know it's important early in sobriety for you to realize that I just have to make it through today. But at some point in time, you have to commit to this thing wholeheartedly for the rest of your life. There must be no lurking notion in your mind that this is going to work. If you still think that I just need to stay sober today, I just need to stay clean today, but tomorrow I can go get banged up, you're not done.
I mean, guys, it's been years since I've prayed for God to keep me clean and sober. You know why? Because there's not one day where I wake up where it occurs to me I'm not going to be clean and sober on that day. In a fit spiritual condition, the desire to access alcohol and drugs as some form of solution has completely been removed. The illusion that I had a choice, or I ever did, is completely been removed. I've learned how to live my life one day at a time. I live life one day at a time. I do not stay clean and sober one miserable day at a time.
I mean, what kind of hope does that give somebody that's new? You're going to struggle with this forever. Thanks.
So, guys, the strenuous work is working with others. It just said it right there in the book. That's the work. That's so your personal journey through the step work, that's the prep work. It's preparing you to be an effective sponsor. That's the deal here. Work and self-sacrifice for others is how you perfect and enlarge your spiritual life. And you'll have permanent recovery. I guarantee every guy that I sponsor, if you stay active in this circle and triangle, I will guarantee you, you will get clean and sober, you will live clean and sober, and you will die clean and sober. Some people think I'm crazy for making that guarantee. But I do it all the time. And a lot of guys stay clean and sober because they stay active in recovery, unity, and service. And then I have the guys that come back to me after a relapse, and it is imperative. Imperative that when you get guys that come back from relapse, you have to pick their circle and triangle apart. You must show them how they weren't really in the program. And I am baffled every single time by how many guys say they were in the program, and I start digging. Okay, let's talk about that first eighth step list. How many amends did you have on it? I had 75. Well, how many did you make? 25. So you did not complete step 8 or 9. Let's get that straight first. Let's talk about the 10th step. What kind of awareness and communication did you have with God throughout the day? And did you have an accountability network? And did they know what you were struggling with? And there's always stuff you're hiding. There's always dishonesty in a relapse. And then I talk about prayer and meditation. Let's talk about this important relationship you're supposed to be cultivating. What would happen if you and your girlfriend only spent 5 minutes together in the morning and 5 minutes together at night? How would that relationship look? Not very strong. What were you doing to nurture and cultivate your relationship with God? I find out there wasn't a lot going on. Were you sponsoring anyone? Well, no. Well, I mean, 5 out of 12 steps are not being worked. So clearly, it's not now surprising that you relapse. You guys see what I'm getting at? It's important to have that. I'm trying to give you some tools as you begin to sponsor people, because a lot of people come back from the relapses and they're like, screw AA, screw the 12 steps. I already tried it. Doesn't work. The reality is, no, you weren't in it.
So we got this relationship with God that we're supposed to have constant contact with, but we're going to spend 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes evening. I'm going to use the example that Tarek said. You're in this relationship with another person, okay? You spend 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes in the evening, and you kind of get a little hankering in the evening, right? You want to get a little busy, right? Get some action. What's that response going to look like? Get the little dolphin. But yet, we don't want to spend the 5 minutes in the morning. We don't want to spend but 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes in the evening, if that. And then when drugs and alcohol are on us, we're like, God, please help us. It's like, Because it's a relationship. Does anybody know what a relationship's like? You ever had one? A good, constructive relationship, two-way communication? So, this stuff is not rocket science, guys. It's not rocket science. It's really, really basic and easy if you start to just really read what it says. So, do you have anything?
And somebody's sitting in here saying to themselves, damn, dude, I just want to stop shooting dope. What are these crazy guys talking about? All right, guys, we start tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.
We got speaker tonight, right?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Jess, I'm just making an announcement. We have a speaker coming up in 15 minutes. But tomorrow morning we start at 10, so I know some of you guys have some other obligations you got to attend to, so we'll be here. Lunch will be served between 12 and 12:30. We'll have pizza brought in, and then we'll be going all day, and then we'll see what happens. So 15-minute break. Right now it's 8:50. Let's come back at 9:05.